Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After all the campaigning, it's just 8 days now until the actual vote. And the debate over the vote itself is as fiery as any political speech. Acorn, Mickey Mouse, registration fraud, vote suppression, never mind the ballots. The integrity of the vote itself is a deeply serious issue and a political football. This hour, On Point, the American vote and its challenges. You can join the conversation. Are you confident? Confident enough? With America's registration and voting process. We will be joined by lawyer and activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who warns of vote suppression. Joining me first from Washington is John Fund, columnist for The Wall Street Journal and author of Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy, originally published in 2004, revised and updated for 2008. John Fund, welcome to On Point.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Your headline in the New York Post earlier this month, voter fraud expected to be rampant. And yet, when I look at what academics are writing, those who follow this professionally around the country, they say the opposite. What's up with that, Mr. Fund?
Well, first of all, you must realize that writers never pick the headlines for their articles. I did not write that headline. I would say rather the danger of voter fraud is serious, and I think it should be of concern to all Americans, because polls, 40% of Americans do not believe our ballots are counted properly. In other words, a large chunk of people believe that there is voter suppression, an even larger chunk believe there is significant voter fraud, so that in a close election, and we have more close elections now than we've ever had, the chance of voter suppression or voter fraud tipping the balance or making up the difference between the two candidates is greater than ever.
40% not having confidence in the outcome of the vote is a serious issue in a democracy. Do you think that that level of public concern is justified, or is that overblown?
It depends on the area that you're in. I think there's some states that have very good and efficient election systems that do not have a tradition of corruption or of, shall we say, an odious historical past. There are other places that are notorious. If you go to Philadelphia, the lawyer for Netroots Nation, which is the leading liberal bloggers, will tell you lots of stories about how reformed Democrats have had elections stolen from them by machine Democrats. If you go to Chicago, you will hear lots of stories about how reformed Democrats have had elections stolen from them by the Daily Machine. If you go to Detroit and you talk to Democrats who tried to challenge Kwame Kilpatrick's mayoral race last year in Detroit, that election, they say, was stolen from them by absentee ballot fraud. This clerk in Detroit had to resign because of the rampant inefficiency and problems in her office. If you go all around this country, you will find pockets and areas where there is serious and systemic voter fraud. You will also find areas where there is still lingering voter suppression. And you will find areas where there are deplorable tactics, such as in Baltimore, where a couple of years ago there were flyers distributed saying Democrats should vote on Wednesday, Republicans should vote on Tuesday. So I think this is an area, election, especially in a swing state, this could make a difference.
Is John McCain over the top when he calls what we heard recently about Acorn one of the greatest frauds in voter history, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy? Is that justified? Is that too much?
If the election is close enough in the end, obviously it could be dangerous to the fabric of our democracy. In Florida in 2000, no one anticipated the problems we ended up having with hanging chads and butterfly ballots and recounts, recriminations, and rogue lawsuits. Ultimately, though, we elected a president who was under a cloud. There were a significant chunk of the American people who felt that President Bush lacked legitimacy. And until 9/11, that cast a pall over his administration. Tom, here's my problem.
Mm.
In 2000, we could afford an internal debate over hanging chads, butterfly ballots. We were at peace. It was before 9/11. The economy was doing well. Now we have an economic meltdown. We've got enemies from Iran to North Korea to Hugo Chavez. We have serious international crises. This is not the time to have an election. It doesn't look like it's close now, but I think it will be closer. It's is not the time to have an election in which any president who takes office has any stain or shadow over their legitimacy. We need all hands on deck. Whoever the next president is going to be lead us and is going to have the full confidence and trust of the American people. With 40% of the people already worried about the integrity of our election systems, we're in potential trouble.
And John, what do you say to some Democrats who say Republicans are stoking this fear of voter fraud in order to push back against wider voter registration, a more inclusive vote with more minorities, more poor, that they see that as a threat to Republican office holders? And so they're creating this theme in order to dampen voter registration efforts.
Well, I think they would be more credible if they didn't completely deny the existence of voter fraud, which is what most of them do. Look, voter registration fraud often and usually does not lead to actual voter fraud. But in Ohio, we have documented examples of registrations collected by Acorn and other groups that have already translated into actual votes by early voting. We had the group in Columbus, Ohio, the 13 people who moved in illegally from New York, established themselves as Ohio residents with no intention of staying in the state. Their ballots were counted. Those ballots have been now made null and void by the prosecutor. There are other examples. Mr. Bill Nash, who was an Acorn volunteer who registered illegally and then cast an illegal vote. In addition, it was the Democratic Attorney General and the Democratic Secretary of State in Nevada who led that raid on Acorn's headquarters because he said their quality control efforts were pathetic. It was the Democratic Deputy Director of Elections in St. Louis who has called Acorn's promises pathetic and said they never keep their promises. It is Democrats like former Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska who has expressed concern about Acorn. It is Democrats like Lanny Davis, President Clinton's former counsel, who says Acorn has gone over the line. I can give you Democrat after Democrat who this year has stepped forward and said, look, we want new voters. We want voter registration. But Acorn is casting a stain on this election, and their tactics should not be endorsed.
John Fund, author of Stealing Elections and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Here's Senator John McCain, October 15th, with harsh words in his last presidential debate on the community organizing group and registration push group, ACORN, and for Barack Obama's what he called his alleged connections with the group.
We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with ACORN, who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying a fabric of democracy.
That is a big charge. We're going to hear in a moment from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who points to voter suppression as the big problem around balloting. Let me go right now, though, to Nate Persily, nationally recognized expert on election law, professor at Columbia Law School, founder and director of the law school's Center on Law and Politics. Nate Persily, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is hard stuff for Americans to hear. We're going to be voting in a week and a day, and people want to have confidence in the election. Can they? Should they? Do we have to judge this, you know, state by state, county by county? Can people go with confidence to the polls?
Well, I think that the greater problem this election season is more that we're unprepared for the tsunami of turnout that we're going to see, that both the questions of illegally cast votes or suppression are actually going to be overwhelmed by the basic unpreparedness we have for the nuts and bolts of actually administering this election. But John Fund is right that there is a huge lack of confidence that Americans have, a large share of Americans have, that their vote will be accurately cast and counted.
Is that lack of confidence justified, or does it look to you from an academic perch like it's ginned up for political reasons by one side or the other, both?
Well, again, there's no question that there has been voter registration fraud. That's the, you know, the slippage in the term fraud is in part to blame. You know, we're seeing, you know, yes, it is true that Acorn has registered Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse and the Dallas Cowboys.
They've acknowledged that. They've said we've gone to fix that.
Right. And but even so, you know, and they're every election, there are tens of thousands of illegal, you know, registrants on the rolls. But that doesn't translate into voter fraud. Just because Mickey Mouse is registered to vote doesn't mean he's going to show up on election day. And so we have, you know, those types of problems. And there's been a lot of media coverage of those problems. And so therefore, the American public hears about this illegal activity and puts it into that same box of voter fraud. And so therefore, there's less in confidence. We also just see, I should say, though, that the people people in a study that I did on perceptions of voter fraud that it's pretty widely shared among all racial groups and partisan groups, that Democrats are afraid their votes are not going to count. Republicans are also afraid of vote fraud. And so it is just a lack of trust that Americans have in government generally these days.
But after all the big numbers I've heard thrown around, I've read statements saying only maybe a couple of dozen votes are actually fraudulently cast in any given election, a couple of dozen in a country of hundreds of millions.
Well, partly that is because the only evidence we really have in the end is of prosecutions, and there are very, very few prosecutions for voter fraud. Anytime you have a process that's going to be counting 130 million votes, some of those are going to be illegitimate, and there will be some, as Mr. Kennedy's going to attest to, where legitimate voters will be prevented from voting. It is a giant administrative undertaking. But for the most part, as you hinted earlier, the academics who've looked at this don't find any conspiracy to commit voter fraud. For instance, for people to register under imaginary names and then show up at the poll and vote in those names.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the American vote and the challenges it is facing now and next Tuesday, November 4th. We've been joined by Nate Persily at Columbia Law School Center on Law and Politics, big expert on election law. They're joining us right now from White Plains, New York, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., lawyer and activist, co-author with journalist Greg Palast of the article Block the Vote in the October 30th issue of Rolling Stone. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Not rock the vote, but block the vote. What do you see going on out there?
Well, I think both Tom or John Fund and Nate Persily have pointed out that the issue of voter fraud, where voters actually show up at the poll, using the names of dead people or what have you. Is not really a serious problem in this country. And in fact, as you pointed out, there's been 24 in since 2002, there's only been 24 proven cases of voter fraud of I think 270 million votes cast. And it's not from lack of looking, because the Justice Department has made a major effort to try to find examples of voter fraud to fuel what I would call a public hysteria in order to justify the erection of all of these impediments that have now become a part of the national voting landscape that allow actual election fraud. And there's a difference. Voter fraud is when single voters when somebody tries to try to vote twice, whereas election fraud is when you try to steal an entire election by suppressing votes, by purging votes, by not counting votes. And if you look at the Help America Vote Act, which is the federal statute that was passed supposedly to avoid a repeat of the debacle during the 2002 election in Florida, or the 2000 election in Florida, that now we have a whole series of basically voting has become an obstacle course where it's now more difficult to register. It's more difficult, or there's new impediments to registration. There's new impediments to actually casting your vote, like licensing, voter ID requirements. Mm-hmm. And then there's new impediments to having your vote counted. In the state of Colorado, in last year, almost there was 1/5, 19.4 of the percent of the votes were actually purged from the voting rolls. In New Mexico, 1 out of every 9 Democratic voters, and these are legitimate voters who came to the polls, found that their registrations had disappeared. Well, this is a huge, a far greater problem than anything that Acorn has done. As everybody's pointed out, what Acorn did didn't have anything to do with stealing votes. It was registration fraud, where people actually were defrauding Acorn. You know, Mickey Mouse is not going to show up and vote. Donald Duck is not going to show up and vote. The guy, the homeless man who was registered 17 times, can only vote once. That doesn't allow him to vote 17 times. In fact, there's no law against registering 17 times. It's the last registration that counts. The people who were registered from the phone books are not going to come in and vote twice. So it's not, this is not a problem that is going to change the results of election. But the Republican efforts certainly have the potential to change the course of elections.
Put this in some historical terms for us. You're describing it in a pretty dire context, looking back to the Jim Crow century after the Civil War, when there were so many restrictions on voters, voters of color in this country. Let's say when your father, Bobby Kennedy, was Attorney General in the early 60s, are you really suggesting that we're back to a level of vote discouragement, vote suppression equivalent to what we saw at the end of that century after the Civil War?
It's different. You know, there was all these requirements that were designed to keep black Americans from voting in the South. I was raised in Virginia, and there were counties in Virginia where there were large black populations where you had to take literacy tests. And whites who came in to take literacy tests were asked simple questions like, what is your favorite color? Whereas classically, blacks who came in were asked to read Chinese newspapers, or they were asked how many bubbles are there in a bar of soap, you know, impossible questions.
But you're raising that now in the context of 2008. Okay, are you comparing these?
Here's what the evidence says, Tom. The evidence shows that the algorithms that are used by Republican secretaries of state to implement the requirements of HAVA, of the Help America Vote Act, are algorithms that disproportionately deprive or disenfranchise black Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans from voting. The U.S. Election Commission, which is a nonpartisan government agency, has found that blacks are 9 times more likely to have their votes thrown out than whites. And if you look at who was thrown out, who lost their votes, for example, in the primary this year on the Super Tuesday primary in the state of New Mexico, it 1 out of every 9 Democratic voters, well, almost all of them were Hispanic. The licensing, let me tell you, I mean, one of the mechanisms that they're now using is these photo ID requirements. You're required to you're required to show up at the polls with a photo ID, a government-issued photo ID.
Yep.
Well, you may say, well, that's easy. Everybody has a driver's license. But, in fact, everybody doesn't have a driver's license. 1 in 10 Americans don't have a driver's license. Who are they? They're senior citizens. They're very young people, young voters, and they're people who live in urban areas and blacks. 1 out of every 5 black of voting age has no driver's license in America. That means that by requiring a photo ID, you're effectively disenfranchising 20% of the black voters. And then there's a number of other mechanisms that are used to disenfranchise black voters. One of these is the provisional ballot. The African Americans, according to the U.S. Election Commission, were disproportionately handed provisional ballots. Provisional ballots are ballots that are given to voters when their vote is challenged. So 1/3 of the provisional ballots that were given to Americans in 2004 were simply thrown into dumpsters. They were not counted. Over 665,000 ballots. According to the U.S. Election Commission, there were at least 2.7 million voters whose votes were not counted, legitimate voters, and probably around 1 million of those were black. So there is a Jim Crow aspect to this. It's not, you know, exactly the same as Jim Crow, and it's not it doesn't necessarily affect the same regions. In fact, a North Carolina voter who's black is almost certain to have their vote counted, whereas an Ohio voter who's black or a Colorado voter who's Hispanic or a New Mexico voter who's Hispanic is much less likely than a white voter have their vote counted.
We, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in White Plains, standby. We asked John Fund to stick around to go at this question. He declined, but Nate, personally, we've got you, and we need your perspective. We'll look at in more detail at some of the charges that Robert Kennedy is making here. But what do you make of the overall characterization of our voting landscape as one in which significant numbers of minorities, the poor, and others are being disenfranchised?
Well, it's certainly the case, take voter ID laws, for example, that there is a disparate racial impact from requirements that people have voter ID. And those stats that Mr. Kennedy was talking about are correct. To some extent, we didn't see in at least the Indiana primary the kind of disenfranchisement that many had expected beforehand. So the best estimates are, for example, that about 500 people in Indiana in the primary ended up casting provisional ballots that were not counted because of a voter ID problem. Now, that doesn't account for the possibility that a lot of people didn't show up on election day because they don't have voter ID, you know, photo ID that satisfied the law. The problem, to give a little more depth to what Mr. Kennedy was saying, is that we don't have the Help America Vote Act requires secretaries of state to compare voter registration lists with some other database. And so then the question is, what do you do when the voter registration database is compared either with the Social Security database or the DMV database, right, and there are mistakes that are noted? Mm-hmm. Now, almost all of those mistakes are trivial and of no significance.
Transposed letters or a phone number off, right, by one digit. Or,
mm-hmm. Right. But now we have, for example, in Ohio, when they compare the list, they have 200,000 voters who don't match. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do with that? And so the Republicans and now maybe even the Department of Justice may be getting involved are saying, all right, those no match lists then have to go to the county boards and into the polling place and then maybe become the source of challenges to voters. Registration status. My prediction on this, and this might be where Mr. Kennedy and I diverge, is that this type of activity is not going to be as significant on election day as we expect. And that's because in 2004, the Republicans at the same time had been waving this flag that they were going to challenge a lot of voters, but in the end it didn't materialize. Part of that is because the Democrats will try to put a stop to it immediately. But as I said at the beginning, all of this stuff pales in comparison to the logistical challenges that we are simply going to face because of high African American turnout, in particular in high African American areas, so that the basic mechanics of administering this election could really lead to the disenfranchisement or to problems at the polls of an even greater magnitude than what was just discussed.
We'll look at basic mechanics. Let me take a call right here from Canton, New York, and Richard. Richard, you're on the air with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Nate Persily.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. What do you see, Richard?
Well, I can substantiate nearly all the points that Robert Kennedy has made, if you'll give me a moment to do so. I've spent years investigating the 2004 Ohio election and a book called Witness to a Crime. And let me start with voter fraud. I will restrict my observations to Cuyahoga County, where Cleveland is located.
Mm-hmm.
I examined 36 voter signature books in Cuyahoga County. I found 722 duplicate registrations on the rolls. Zero of these people voted more than once. The reason they appeared more than once on the voter rolls was because of groups like Acorn where the people carrying the applications for voter registration would make more money if they submitted more registrations, and a simple data entry error on the part of the clerks at the Board of Elections would allow that duplicate registration to sail through.
So there it was, but not two votes, you're saying?
No, nobody voted twice. I checked every single one of these 722, and that's a pretty large database.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the reasons this happened is if a voter was already registered, the canvassers would say, oh, you need to do it again. And that's not an unreasonable request because the 168,000 names were purged from the voter rolls in Cuyahoga County in 2001 and 2003, including 64,000 in Cleveland alone. And this did not correlate with the percentage of people who had not voted in the last 4 years. Rather, the percentage of voters purged correlated better with the percentage of the vote won by Al Gore in 2000. Democratic wards and precincts were targeted for partisan political advantage.
Stick with us, Richard. Robert Kinley, it sounds like you all may know each other. Are these the kind of numbers that lead you to your conclusion, Robert, that we've got vote-changing problems here?
Well, the problem also that, you know, we don't know each other. The problem, you know, Professor Persily, acknowledged was that there's going to be problems with the large turnout, but the problems that we're going to have with the large turnout are aggravated by all of these other attempts by the Republicans to suppress or to complicate the vote. If you've got, as you did in 2004, Republican attorneys in every black precinct challenging with challenge lists, waiting to challenge voters who were whose names have been purged from the list, whose names who have been mismatched, or who have not responded to return receipt requested letters that were sent out illegally. It's called like caging, which the Republican Party has engaged in virtually every presidential election in the past decade. That makes these longer lines because you challenge the voter, it holds up the line. And that's why in Cuyahoga County, that's one of the reasons we had 13-hour lines for black people. Now, if you're a working person in an African-American neighborhood, you oftentimes can't vote. You don't have 13 hours to vote. You can't take off all of Tuesday. So you drive past the line or you see it on TV, your boss gives you a half an hour for lunch break, you intend to vote. Well, your vote's not going to get cast. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, that's one of the strategies of all of these behind all of these complications and impediments is actually to magnify and amplify the long lines at the voter booth on election day at those precincts where there's large African-American populations. And, you know, Professor Persily said that in Indiana, there's only 500 people were excluded, but that's a lot more people than have ever been proven to have engaged in voter fraud. So, you know, and that may not be significant. That kind of number may not be significant in Indiana, but it certainly would be significant in very, very close states like for example, New Mexico, which was won by 300 votes in 2000 by Al Gore and lost by less than 5,000 votes in 2004 by George Bush. So these are significant numbers, and actually the numbers are enormous when you look at, you know, I talked about Donetta Davidson, who was the former Republican Secretary of State of Colorado, who purged one out of every five voters on the list this time around. So those are all people who are going to be challenged. That's going to make the long lines much longer on election day. Her successor, another Republican, Mike Kaufman, the New York Times reported last week, has purged an additional 37,000 voters. We don't know which voters. We don't know. He's refused interview requests. He's refused any explanation about the algorithms he used or the methods he used to exclude those voters. Plus, he has, let's say, deregistered, he admitted, 6,400 new voters. Well, almost all of those new voters, for reasons, again, he refused to disclose.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the American vote and the challenges it's facing now and next Tuesday, November 4th. And, of course, you heard John McCain's charges on ACORN, threat to democracy, he says. We've been joined this hour by Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., lawyer and activist, co-author of the big story Block the Vote in the October 30th issue of Rolling Stone. He paid a lot of attention to what happened in Ohio after the 2004 vote there. We're joined from New York as well by Nate Persily. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, nationally recognized expert on election law. Let's take a call from Portland, Maine, and Glenway. Glenway, you're on the air.
Hi. I want to amplify something that Mr. Kennedy said about long lines in black districts, and that is that it seems more a problem of long lines in districts where people are poor, that the richer the town is, the more voting machines per capita they have, and that it would be do a good service to an equal and fair election to have a law requiring the same amount of voting machines per capita in any voting district, so that everybody had an equal opportunity and equal ease of voting.
Let us pick that up. Nate Persily, how big an issue are the raw mechanics at that level of getting voters through the balloting places, and how do you stack that up to the kind of challenge that Robert Kennedy Jr. is describing in the purges that attorney generals around the country are doing of voter rolls?
Well, again, the long lines come from a lot of mess ups in the polling place. It is true, as Robert Kennedy was saying, that in the event you have widespread challenges on election day, particularly in heavily African American areas, that will lead to chaos at the polls and lead to long lines. For the most part, the long lines that we saw in Ohio were not as a result of those types of problems. They were a result of huge amount of incompetence at the polls, the shortage of voting machines, and the fact that they were just simply not prepared for the kind of turnout that we had. Similarly, and I want to just stress this so it doesn't seem like I'm minimizing the danger here, mm-hmm. 500 voters is a lot of voters in Indiana. It's not as many as we might have thought would not have ended up voting because of – or whose ballots would not have been counted because of a lack of photo ID. 40,000 people in Indiana who are of voting age don't have photo ID, and yet we saw 500 in the primaries. Maybe that'll be double or triple the number this time, and I don't mean to suggest that is a small number. As to what the caller was saying, yes, you know, there is a problem in that that richer counties end up having better polling places, better training, better machines than the poorer counties. Sometimes it's actually not the right move to just do number of voting machines per capita. You actually have to have a very good forecast for the number of voters who are going to show up on election day so that, for example, in this election, it's possible we're going to actually get higher African-American turnout than white turnout in some mm-hmm. areas. And so we want to make sure there are the right number of voting machines there. And so the problem, as the Caltech MIT study after the 2000 election showed and mm-hmm. other academic studies have shown, is that the variations between counties are often more important than the variations, say, between technologies and other things, which is that there are good counties and there are bad counties. And it's better to actually be in a county and a polling place where people are better trained and professionalized than it is to have, say, the best technology, but at the same time to be in a poorly run polling place or county.
Robert Kennedy is very tough on the Help Americans to Vote Act that was brought in after the debacle in 2000, suggesting that it's been used in all the wrong ways and given some tools that aren't right here. How do you look at that? Do you see evidence of, I don't know, conspiracy to gum up voting or an effort to clean up voting as attorney generals use this law?
Well, I share his concerns about the Help America Vote Act, probably more from just the entire piece of legislation has turned out to be a real mess and hasn't helped Americans vote at all. You have to realize that the Help America Vote Act was basically a deal that was cut between those who were afraid of vote fraud on the one hand and those who wanted to encourage access. The provisional ballots, which are now guaranteed under the Help America Vote Act, so if you show up in the polling place and your name is not on the rolls mm-hmm. or if you're challenged, that then you cast provisional ballots, that was in order to prevent what some people saw in the 2000 election in Florida where people – where there was a purge particularly of using – an inaccurate list of felons so that there were a lot of people who were not felons but who had names that matched their felon list that then were taken off the rolls. Help America Vote Act now requires that first-time voters who register by mail have to show some kind of ID when they get to the polling place. It's not a photo ID necessarily, but there's a list of approved IDs. And that was sort of the beginning of this debate in a lot of ways between those who are advocating photo ID on the one hand and those who are worried more about voter suppression. I mean, obviously there are early incarnations of this not only in the South and then in Tammany Hall, but the modern discussion on this really began with this deal in the Help America Vote Act. And so it was really a compromise piece of legislation, which was the only way that the Republicans and Democrats were going to respond in any way. It also included lots of money to move toward electronic and more sophisticated voting machines, which we're now sort of dialing back from in this election.
Robert Kennedy, we've talked a number of times on this show with David Iglesias, who was the U.S. attorney in New Mexico who got caught up in the middle of the whole, speaking of purges, of the kind of purge U.S. attorneys by the Justice Department. And he has said that he believes that was in part because he didn't want to get involved in what he thought were illegitimate charges of vote tampering in advance of an election. Do you see, are you suggesting there is some like a conspiracy to lean on these laws to the point that they distort the American vote?
Well, you know, my article, and first of all, David Iglesias has said repeatedly, and you know, we have him quoted in the article as saying Greg Palast and I, who was my co-author on this piece, is that he was given. That he was put under enormous pressure by the Justice Department to find voter fraud cases. He was given a list of 200 complaints. He investigated them for 2 years. He couldn't find a single legitimate one. And that when he refused to when he said he couldn't find a legitimate one, he was ordered by Alberto Gonzalez to prosecute anyway a frivolous case, which is actually illegal. And his refusal to do that was what led to his firing. Now, this is it's certainly part of a Republican, I don't know whether you'd call it conspiracy, I'd say it's a strategy or a campaign to gin up hysteria about illegal votes, about fraudulent voting. And we saw that in the debate when John McCain said that Acorn was threatening the fabric of our democracy and was perpetuating the greatest fraud in American history, when not a single vote, illegal vote, was found as a result of Acorn. But what, you know, the Help America Vote Act was then, it was a compromise, as Professor Persily says, and it ended up, Bob Ney and Jack Abramoff, who are both now in prison, ended up writing a lot of these new provisions that are designed to create impediments to new voters. There's just two things that I would like to say. One is that we're spending now an estimated, according to Office of Management and Budget, it's going to cost us $4.5 trillion to prosecute the Iraq War and the cost of that war. To establish democracy in Iraq, we can spend a few billion dollars if we need to make sure that people don't have to wait 13 hours at a voting machine in Ohio. You know, we're trying to establish democracy in Iraq. We ought to have democracy in this country. We ought to be encouraging every American to vote, whatever their color, whatever their economic status, and we shouldn't be erecting these impediments. There are states that do this, and they do it well. In North Carolina, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, is one of those. They encourage everybody to vote, and they've got this heritage that comes, you know, from way back in the populist era that they've held on to, that the votes have, you know, that they have a good voting system. It works. There's not a lot of illegal voting or anything like that, and the state is actually, and state officials are actually encouraging people to vote, and they're making it easy to vote. One of the things that Professor Persily mentioned that really should be stressed to people this time around is that there is this new requirement that first-time voters show a photo ID. Many people who are first-time voters who I've met around the country are unaware of this requirement.
Is that a national requirement or state by state?
It's part of HAVA, but it's a stone requirement in many states, like Florida, some of the swing states. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it applies to every state. Mm-hmm. It applies to some of the – perhaps Professor Persily could probably speak to that better than I could. But the thing that people should know who are listening to this program is that a lot of first-time voters are young people who are intending to vote by mail. And if they don't, for example, in Florida, the law requires that if you vote by mail and you're a first-time voter, that you include a copy of your – photo ID, and that the photo ID be included in a special smaller envelope that is inserted in your vote by mail envelope.
That's complicated.
Most voters don't know this, and those votes are going to be simply thrown out when they're received by the registry.
Nate Persily, what about it? Are most states requiring photo ID for first-time voters this time and in a smaller envelope, inside the envelope, et cetera? Are people well informed?
Well, let's be clear about what the federal law is and then what the state laws are. Mm. First of all, the HAVA requires that first-time voters who registered by mail, not, for example, those who registered at a DMV or elsewhere,
okay, right.
Those who registered by mail have to present some kind of ID. And it's not just a photo ID. There's a list of other possible IDs, including utility checks and bank statements and some other things. Now, that's the federal law. Now, there's certain states that have much stricter laws. Indiana now has the strictest law in the nation, which says you must show a photo ID, government-issued photo ID, and we even have an example of where Congresswoman Julia Carson showed up with her ID as a U.S. Congresswoman, and she was turned away from the polls because you actually have to have a specific type of government-issued photo ID. What will happen is if you show up on the polling places and you don't have the right identification, then you'll be asked to cast a provisional ballot. And usually that and Florida is an example of this, what you have to do if you have a defect of that nature is you have to go back to the either the county seat or a central polling place in order to cure that defect and show your ID within 24 hours.
And when people do show up, I mean, we heard Joe the plumber, Samuel Joseph Wurzelbacher's name was misspelled in the Ohio rolls. Is he then likely to be challenged? Is that settled? They wanted to go to the Supreme Court, and I guess the court didn't pick it up. Where does that stand in Ohio, Nate?
Well, right now where we are is that the Secretary of State's decision not to show the mismatched voters to the local county boards of elections is the policy. So you're not going to have no match lists that are going to be sent down to the polling place, as far as we know at this point. But the DOJ, the White House has now asked the Department of Justice to investigate this on the urgings of some members of Congress. And so there's a chance that this might change. The problem there is that at least the Secretary of State in Ohio says that it's a relatively complicated enterprise to to actually generate these no-match lists because you have to account for those types of typographical errors and things like that. And, you know, we're only a week away. And so the Secretary of State in Ohio and the boards of elections have a lot to do between now and the election day. And so this is the kind of thing that they probably, would be the type of thing they don't want to add onto their burdens.
To be fair, on the other side of this ledger, what we saw in these ACORN numbers and ultimately they coming out and saying they had way fewer than 1.3 million new voters registered. I mean, that did not look at all good either. Is that really necessary to get new voters registered, which any democracy should want? Does it have to be as ugly as that, Nate?
Well, let me also say that ACORN should not be held blameless here, and it feeds into what I was saying before, which is that despite the mechanisms that they had for quality control, there are at least tens of thousands, if not more, faulty registration forms that they dumped on these local overburdened election officials in areas where we should be very concerned about the administration of these elections. So that while I don't think there's any organized fraud, just from the administrative burden that they've placed on these officials, it is of great concern. But highlighting something that Robert Kennedy was saying before, we in the U.S. continue to make it more difficult to vote than any other country in the world. And that's because we require people to re-register each time they move their location. Mm-hmm. So we are the most mobile country in the world, where one-fourth of the U.S. population moves every 2 years. And each time you move, you have to re-register at your new address. Most other countries in the world have – the government takes on an obligation of registering their citizens. And all those demographic characteristics, whether it's race, age, education levels that are highly correlated with transiency, also are highly correlated with lower voter turnout.
Robert Kennedy, surely there is a better way than the kind of Mickey Mouse stuff we saw in the ACORN rolls, no?
Well, yeah, I agree 100% with Professor Persily that ACORN shouldn't be held blameless. But the idea of, the use of ACORN's mistakes to amplify these Republican hysteria, that there's this huge problem with voter fraud in this country, has obscured a much greater issue, which is that there's literally hundreds of thousands. Well, there may be a tiny handful, of tens of people who commit voter fraud, or even hundreds, let's say, across the nation that aren't caught. There are hundreds of thousands of legitimate voters who are being denied their franchise every single year that they're disproportionately Democratic, they're disproportionately minority, they're black, they're Hispanic, they're Native American, and they're poor. They have a right to vote in this country, and they are being systematically excluded by a system that is designed to exclude them.
What do you think are the odds that we'll be back in the courts after next Tuesday? God help us. But looking at right now, how do you see it?
I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I'm optimistic that it won't. I think that the Secretary of State of Ohio is a real hero for standing up and saying, you know, we're not going to exclude these people because there's minor differences. We're not going to deprive 200,000 people who have where there's no real claim that they did anything fraudulent. We're not going to deprive them of their franchise. We're not going to allow people to stand at the polls and challenge them and create long lines. So I think, you know, that's the state. Colorado, I think, is a problem state because so many people have been excluded, and it's going to be, that state is going to be very close in the election, and so there may be problems there. And New Mexico also, there are issues. But I think in most of the other states that you're going to, I don't think that it's going to reach litigation, but who knows?
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., his story in Rolling Stone is Block the Vote. Mr. Kennedy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Nate Persily at Columbia Law School and the Center on Law and Politics. Professor Persily, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.